Hello, it's Monday, July 27th. I'm Mike Duran on today's podcast. Fresh claims British intelligence has been complicit in the torture of British nationals in a foreign country.
He had powder put in his clothing which made him burn and cause blisters on his skin. He was treated in an appalling way and he really thought he was going to be shot by a firing squad.
The Olympic legacy, will there be one?
There are those who say, actually, the link between holding an Olympics, which is a fantastic sort of three-week celebration of sport, and inspiring a nation to be healthier is actually quite a weak one.
MPs tell rail operators they're taking the public for granted.
Rail operators are allowed to raise fares by no more than 1% above inflation, and they've certainly taken advantage of that.
Sarah Palin bows out of politics. What next for the one-time wannabe vice president? Plus a chance to see a rare Peter Sellers film from the 1950s. First, a news update and paper review with Bill Overton.
David Miliband is set to stress the importance of supporting the Afghan government in a speech to NATO today. The Foreign Secretary will focus on how the Allied forces can defeat the Taliban. July has been the deadliest month for the UK and NATO since operations began in 2001. 20 British soldiers have been killed in the past 4 weeks. Yesterday, the UK pledged £225 million in aid to the Afghan government to try to undermine the heroin trade. World Health Organization's raised concerns about the fast-track production of the swine flu vaccine in Europe. Britain's expected to be the first country in Europe to provide the vaccine, with the first dose due to be administered next month. However, the US government's taking a more cautious approach, with thousands of American volunteers due to start testing the vaccine next month, but the Department of Health denies Britain's rushing the process. A spokesman says it was extremely irresponsible to suggest the UK would use an unsafe vaccine. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy is recovering in hospital after collapsing while jogging. The 54-year-old was taken to a military hospital yesterday after becoming ill in the grounds of the Chateau of Versailles near Paris. Gordon Brown sent the President a private message expressing his support and wishing him a speedy recovery. The poorest people in Britain are more than twice as likely to have diabetes than the average person. A study by Diabetes UK blames the prevalence of obesity, physical inactivity and smoking for the increased risk of getting the disease. More than 2 million people in the UK are diabetic. Most have type 2, which is usually associated with lifestyle factors such as being overweight. Britain's Lewis Hamilton was back on top of the podium after winning his first Grand Prix of the year yesterday in Hungary. The reigning world champion struggled with his car this season, but gave credit to his McLaren teammates after his win. Meanwhile, Ferrari's Felipe Massa remains in a stable condition in hospital after surgery on multiple skull fractures. The driver was injured during qualifying after a spring from another car struck his helmet. Now for a look at today's papers, and the head of Britain's fertility watchdog has told The Times the ban on selling sperm and eggs should be reconsidered due to a shortage of donors. The Telegraph leads with claims a Conservative government would introduce tolls on newly built roads if they're elected. Meanwhile, the Mail reports if David Cameron becomes Prime Minister, he'll cut tax credits for households earning over £50,000 a year. Economic recovery is faltering, according to research carried out for The Independent. Months of cautious optimism has been wiped out and there are fears of a so-called double-dip recession. The FT makes for equally gloomy reading. It reports a growing concern over British credit card debt, with the IMF predicting a wave of defaults across Europe. Get £500 to spy on your neighbours is the headline in The Express. It says people who report graffiti and littering could be in line for cash rewards. And Britain's Mark Cavendish makes the back pages of many of the papers after winning a record sixth sprint stage in the Tour de France. Spain's Alberto Contador was the overall winner of the race, which finished in Paris yesterday. Britain's Bradley Wiggins was fourth. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
We start today with a Huddersfield businessman who claims to have been tortured in Dubai with the knowledge of the British intelligence services. Alam Ghaffour has obtained documents, albeit heavily redacted, which he believes shows the British consular officials asked permission from UK security services to visit him while he was detained, meaning they knew he was under interrogation in a foreign country. The Guardian's Helen Carter has spoken to Mr. Ghaffour about what happened to him.
Well, he's in the United Arab Emirates following the London bombings. He was there on a business trip and he was having dinner with some of his friends and they were detained. And the people who detained him didn't explain why initially, and they were basically handcuffed, or they had like handcuffs on their fingers, which are similar similar to cable ties. And they were taken to an unknown place, separated and basically tortured, sleep deprived, and he was hallucinating. And he was accused of being one of the London bombers and being involved with the London, you know, just because he was looked similar, according to the people who were questioning him, he looked similar to one of the London bombers, so must therefore be involved in the London bomb plot.
And this isn't just his opinion, is it? Mr. Kafour has obtained documents under the Freedom of Information Act. What do they show?
They just show that it appears from the documents that it wasn't the United Arab Emirates authorities who were asking for him to be detained, it was the British authorities, but the British authorities are refusing to confirm that. But the documents are so heavily redacted that it's quite difficult to say. I mean, some of them are so heavily redacted that the only words that are left are his name and, you know, where he's from, and everything else is kind of blacked out. So, you know, it's difficult to say what's going on, but they do appear to show that it was somebody other than the authorities in the United Arab Emirates who were responsible for his incarceration.
And has Mr. Kafour been found guilty of anything?
No, he was released. He was deported. Eventually, he was deported. He's not been convicted of any offence. It was a case of mistaken identity, and he's really cross because nobody's apologised to him. He was just dumped back in the UK, and his relationship with his partner split up. He suffered from post-traumatic stress, and became very paranoid and anxious. And he had nightmares, and he believed he was being followed or his phone was being tapped. But this, is obviously 4 years on, he's in a lot stronger place. But he's still very angry that nobody's apologised to him or admitted, or given any explanation why he was treated in such a way.
And if this is true, if the UK authorities have been complicit in the torture of a UK citizen in a foreign country, that would be a breach of human rights law, wouldn't it? What is the government's reaction to this?
They just deny that they involved or, complicit in any way with the torture of a British citizen in a different country. They don't discuss intelligence issues, and they say they don't participate in, solicit, encourage or condone the use of torture or inhuman or degrading treatment for any purpose. And they also say whenever allegations of wrongdoing are made, they're taken seriously and investigated as appropriate. But they do not discuss intelligence issues, so they wouldn't say whether the intelligence agencies were involved in his detention.
But this isn't the first time, is it, that similar accusations have been made?
No, it's a pattern of behaviour. It seems to be a pattern of behaviour. Other cases, it's not just a one-off. It's something that's been going on for some years and away from the UK, where they wouldn't be, they wouldn't be allowed to be treated in such a way. You wouldn't be allowed to be deprived of sleep, to have, he had powder put in his clothing, which made him burn and caused blisters on his skin. I mean, he was treated in an appalling way, and he really thought he was going to be shot by a firing squad. And he was in a terrible state. He was hallucinating that his father was talking to him, his dead father was talking to him, and dead bodies were crawling out of the floor. So, this is an absolutely horrific ordeal, and he was talking about it 4 years on as though it was yesterday. It's obviously still very clear in his mind.
And you can watch the interview between Helen Carter and Alam Kafour online at guardian.co.uk/video. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, full details of President Sarkozy's health scare. That's at guardian.co.uk/news. Is the government ending the amniocentesis test? The answer can be found at guardian.co.uk/health. Equality Commission Chief Trevor Phillips toughs it out as many around him quit. The full story at guardian.co.uk/politics. And the sporting Brits do well in France and Hungary. That's at guardian.co.uk/sport. Next, when Britain won the 2012 Olympic bid, it did so partly by promising a legacy to increase sporting activity and reduce obesity. But senior sports figures and opposition MPs reckon the government has done nothing in 4 years and is unlikely to leave a legacy at all. In order to counter these claims, Labour is to appoint the Sports Legacy Czar, whose job will be to inspire you and me to stop being so lazy. The Guardian sports news correspondent Owen Gibson explains.
Well, I think there's increasing confidence actually in LOCOG, who need to deliver the organisation of the games, and the ODA, who are building the venues that will house the games, that will be there sort of on time and on budget, so we won't face a sort of Athens-type disaster where we're scrambling to get the venues ready. But where the attention is now shifting is what's going to be left behind afterwards. And Seb Coe, Tessa Jow and others made great play of the legacy that the London Olympics would leave, both for sporting participation, for the East End of London and for elite sport in this country. And in each of those areas, there's sort of increasing concern about exactly how that legacy is going to be delivered and what it's going to amount to.
This buzzword, the L word, legacy, how are they going to galvanise this inspiration to leave a legacy?
Well, that's exactly the point, really. I mean, there are those who say, actually, the link between holding an Olympics, which is a fantastic sort of three-week celebration of sport, and inspiring a nation to be healthier, is actually quite a weak one, and they should never have tried to make such a strong case for it in the first place. Then there are those who sort of say that it is a sort of credible plan, but the way they've gone about it today has lacked sort of focus and national coordination. I think there's some sign that the government agrees with that to an extent, because we understand they're now going to sort of put in place a legacy czar, if you like, to try and coordinate some of the national efforts. I mean, the idea being that if somebody's doing good things in grassroots sports in Plymouth, then somebody in Preston doesn't necessarily get to know about it. And I think it's that sort of lack of joined up thinking and lack of big ideas and real sort of inspirational kind of figures to really sort of make the message to the man on the street that's perhaps lacking.
The government wants a million more people to get involved in physical activity, doesn't it, such as walking and gardening. What is the link between the Olympics and gardening, for example?
Well, quite. I mean, the opposition parties have had some fun with this over the last couple of months. Last year it emerged that the criteria for physical activity had been expanded to include gardening and quote-unquote active conservation, whatever that means. And obviously, I mean, I think this was seen as a rather cynical attempt to try and broaden the criteria to ensure they hit the target. And I mean, even the targets are quite confusing. I don't think that it's widely known exactly what they refer to, because people talk about a million more people in sport and a million more people in physical activity, and what the actual targets refer to is 3 times half an hour's exercise or 3 times half an hour sport a week, if you like. So if I'm playing tennis twice a week at the moment and then I tip up to 3, I get included in the million more people in sport. If I'm gardening twice a week and I start gardening 3 times a week, I get included in the million more people in physical activity. So, I mean, I think they need to do more work in explaining what exactly it is they're trying to achieve and how they're going to go about it, rather than, as you say, continually just throwing around buzzwords and endlessly talking about legacy, which can mean almost anything you want it to mean.
And this is the job of the new sports legacy czar, is it? Do we know who that's going to be?
We don't. I mean, I think they'll look for a fairly high profile figure within sport. I mean, they'll be keen that it doesn't just cut across all the existing sporting bodies. I mean, Sport England, its job is to spend £180 million that will be poured into grassroots sports over the next 4 years and try and deliver the legacy on the ground. So they won't want to cut across that. I think the job of this new team within DCMS will be to try and sort of pull together best practice from around the country and to really sort of add some inspiration to the perspiration, was the phrase I heard used, and try and really sort of make it all work a bit harder. And I think it will be a fairly high profile figure, certainly from within the sporting administration world, if not necessarily to the wider public.
Owen Gibson. As rail passengers, we're being taken for granted. That's the conclusion of a cross-party report on the rail industry. The Transport Committee says the franchise system allows train companies to hike fares out of all proportion to the real economy, and that, it says, is unacceptable. The Guardian's transport correspondent Dan Milmo has been looking into the report.
Rail operators are allowed to raise fares by no more than 1% above inflation. And in a recession, they've certainly taken advantage of that. 1% above inflation doesn't sound like a lot, but in fact, what that equated to this year is a rise in regulated fares, which is season tickets and advanced off-peak fares, of 6%, and a rise in unregulated fares of 7%. Now, in a time of recession, the MPs, the Transport Select Committee, have said that that's completely unreasonable and is an indictment of what they call a perverse franchising system.
So how do the rail operators justify their increases?
The rail operators say they're for a start, they provide a very good service. That's the first thing. They run over 20,000 services a day. Punctuality is at record levels, and indeed passenger satisfaction is at record levels. So first and foremost, they say you get a good rail service for your buck. Secondly, I won't say this, but obviously they're doing it because they can. It's not illegal. It follows government guidelines. And, well, yeah, there's a recession on that's affecting passengers, but it's also affecting the rail operators because they need the revenue in order to meet the franchise payments that go to the government under the terms of their rail contracts.
So if everything is going so well, how come the East Coast franchise was nationalised recently?
The East Coast franchise was a victim of rather absurd overambition. What happens in a franchise contract is essentially you bid as a private company for the right to run services on a designated route. Now, if the route is deemed profitable, lucrative, such as the East Coast mainline, which runs from London through Newcastle to Edinburgh, then the government invites you to bid a premium for that right, say over 10 years. National Express East Coast saw pound signs lighting up in front of it when it bid for this contract and bid $1.4 billion over 7.5 years. Quite understandably, 2 years into the contract and in the middle of a recession, National Express said, we can't afford this, and handed it back. So what you could say is that National Express were a victim of greed, certainly. But secondly, and this is where I think the criticism is justified, National Express has simply walked away from a £1.4 billion pledge when the going got tough. Now, the criticism that is being levied at the government is, why was National Express allowed to do that? How could it just down the contract when it didn't feel like fulfilling it anymore? Because the taxpayer now effectively picks up the bill. The state's going to run National Express East Coast for a year, and then it's going to hopefully re-tender the contract and get, you know, £1.4 billion back. Well, in a recession, are they likely to get £1.4 billion? No. So we end up picking up the bill.
Still to come, a rarely seen Peter Sellers movie gets a new showing.
Peter Sellers himself said it's a terrifyingly bad film. So I didn't have very high expectations.
Before that, remember this.
As Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America, where do they go? It's Alaska.
The one-time vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, during her much-maligned campaign. It's less than a year since Sarah Palin was picked to be John McCain's presidential running mate. Now she's standing down as governor of Alaska. With 20 ethics complaints and mounting legal bills to deal with, the rumour mill is turning about what she's going to do next. Is this a strategic move to run for president in 2012? Or will she prefer to host a TV show? The speculation doesn't start here, but we're going to add our own, with The Guardian's Ed Pilkington.
Sarah Palin was at a picnic in Fairbanks, one of the main towns in Alaska, yesterday, at which she made her final resignation speech. But it has to be said that she begins her life as plain old Sarah Palin, without the title of governor, amid a huge sort of cloud of confusion, with the speculation rife and equally divided between those who think she's just begun her run on the White House, and those who essentially think she's toast, that, you know, it's all over because she's now got this quitter label hung around her neck. So she starts her next phase of her political life, I think in classic Palin fashion, amid a huge mound of confusion.
Well, if she is toast, will she have a political life, do you think, or is she looking to go into the private sector?
This is what's baffling about her. I mean, everything about the Palin story since she was first plucked out of relative obscurity last August by the McCain campaign to be his running mate in the presidential elections. Everything has been utterly baffling. And the baffling thing about it now is that we really don't know what she intends. I mean, and that's the sort of first starting point. What does she want to do? Does she really have any national political ambitions? And all we can go by these days are by these sort of tantalizing tweets that she's putting up on her Twitter page, in which in one tweet she'll imply she harbors national ambitions, and the next tweet she'll talk about being in a camper van with her kids admiring the Alaskan wilderness, which leaves you none the wiser, really. Let's assume she does want to run for the White House in 2012. Then, even then, it's kind of not clear whether she'd be successful or a serious candidate. At the moment, her poll ratings are falling, and they're now down to 40% favourability rating, with her unfavourability rating more than 50%, 53%. So there's slippage going on, and I think her resignation will not do her any any good in terms of trying to become a national politician. So there's a big hurdle ahead of her, I think.
And when she opens up her diary, does she just see blank pages?
Well, we just see blank pages because, like everything else, we haven't really got a clue about what she's intending to do. Her spokesperson is saying that today she's going to sit down with Palin and they're going to look at the options ahead of them and start making decisions. All we know is that on August the 8th, Palin is due to speak at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California, and that's her only scheduled appointment that we know about. We also know that she's going to write a memoir, a book. We don't know how much she's being paid for it, but presumably quite a lot of money, and that will go towards her legal fees. She's saddled with quite a huge burden of legal fees as a result of numerous ethics complaints against her in the state of Alaska since she came back from the presidential race. So she has to make quite a lot of money just to pay her legal fees, and she'll be writing a book to do that. But beyond that, we really don't know. I mean, will she sign up to a TV presenting job? Will she, you know, gain a column in a national newspaper? Will she go on a speaker's tour of the country in order to gain a national profile? None of these things we know the answer to.
Where would you put your money?
Well, she hit such a nerve last August in terms of rallying a very despondent and depressed rump of the Republican Party. And she became so wildly popular among them that I think it would be strange if we heard the last from her now, in the sense that that rump is really all that's left of the Republican Party. The sort of middle, moderate, mainstream part of the party has disappeared, and it's going to be a very long and difficult job for the party to regain that following. So in a sense, her support has risen as the party has fallen in terms of the proportion of support she gets within the Republican Party. And with that kind of support behind her, I think it would be, you know, bizarre if she didn't go forward. But then, as I said earlier, everything about the Sarah Palin story has been bizarre.
The Guardian's Ed Pilkington in New York. Finally, a rarely seen film starring Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan and Harry Secom is to be released soon on DVD. Penny Points to Paradise from 1951 will also get a one-off screening tonight at the BFI. Sellers himself said the film was a bit rough around the edges. It didn't do too well on its original release. His percentage of the takings totaled £33.09. The Guardian's arts correspondent Mark Brown has been to see it.
I mean, it really is a kind of sort of hidden gem. I mean, this film, Penny Points to Paradise, it was recorded in December 1950 and got released in 1951. Didn't do very well. Hardly anybody saw it. And then it kind of hasn't really been seen in its original form since then. There have been versions of it. When Peter Sellers became famous, the production company decided, let's re-release the film, but they shortened it and cut it, etc. And there have been versions which have been seen by people like the Goon Appreciation Society have seen versions. But this version, this full restored version, hasn't really been seen since 1951.
And is it any good?
Well, it's better than I expected, I have to say, because I was expecting a pretty ropey film. I mean, Peter Sellers himself, when he was interviewed in the 70s sometime, he said that it was a terrifyingly bad film. So I didn't have very high expectations when I watched it. But, you know, it's quite good. You know, I mean, here you got Peter Sellers, Harry Secom, Spike Milligan, before they're famous, just they're about to become the Goons. And it's quite funny. It's not brilliant. It's not Dr. Strangelove, but it is quite funny.
Do you think he would be happy with it being released?
Even though Peter Sellers said it was a terrifyingly bad film, Sellers was known to be highly self-critical of himself. So I don't think he would have minded. I think he would have wanted people to see him in an early version. Plus, what's interesting about this film is Peter Sellers is by far the strongest performer. Spike Milligan and Harry Secom are a bit ropey, but Peter Sellers, you know, this is his first film, and he's brilliant.
So is it under the guise of a Goon film, then?
No, it's not. The three of them become friends. I think Secom and Milligan became friends during the war, and they met Peter Sellers in 1948 or something at Hackney Empire, and they became friends, and they thought that we should do something together. And then they filmed this film, as I say, in December 1950, And then the next year, they filmed the first series of the Goon series, although they didn't call it that at the time. It was the second series. It became the Goon series. So it was on the cusp. They were about to become famous. And of course, the Goons, you know, completely revolutionized comedy.
I guess I should ask you for a brief synopsis of the film.
Basically, it's Harry Secombe. He plays a gormless idiot called Harry. He's won the pools. He wants to spend. So what a better way to spend than his go with your best mate to Brighton, stop in a B&B, which they do. Within that B&B, there's a crusty old major played by Peter Sellers who becomes their friend. And then a con man played by Alfred Marks learns about the fact that they're staying there and goes down to Brighton and tries to steal the money. And sort of ensues this sort of Keystone Cops type chase and also chase around the waxworks. And, of course, the good guys win.
And finally, where can we see this film?
You can see it tonight at the BFI, but I have a feeling it'll all be sold out, in which case you'll have to wait for it to come out on DVD, which is on the 3rd of August.
The Guardian's Mark Brown. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today were Adam Gabbett and Phil Maynard. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.